6, verses 4 through 9. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord with your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength. These commandments I give to you today are to be upon your hearts. Impress them on your children. Talk about them when you sit at home and when you walk along the road, when you lie down and when you get up. Tie them as symbols on your hands and bind them on your foreheads. Write them on your door frames of your houses and on your gates. And the second one is chapter 16, verses 9 through 12. Count off 7 weeks from the time you begin to put the sickle to the standing grain. Then celebrate the Feast of Weeks to the Lord your God by giving a freewill offering in proportion to the blessings the Lord your God has given you. And rejoice before the Lord your God at the place you will choose as a dwelling for for his name. You, your sons and daughters, and your men servants and maidservants, the Levites in your towns and the aliens, the fatherless and the widows living among you. Remember that you were slaves in Egypt and follow carefully these decrees.
This morning we're blessed to have Tim Willis from Pepperdine. He teaches Old Testament there. He has degrees in religion from Abilene and Harvard University. I'm intrigued by that. I can't think of two more dialectic places, Boston or at least Massachusetts and Texas, and although they've both have religious roots. But he's come this morning to speak to us about godly families in the family of God.
Well, it's good to be here this morning. I won't go there. Okay. I wish my wife could have been here with me this morning. I explained it to Dave why she couldn't. It's one of those things where she has obligations at our home congregation. We're at Conejo Valley, and basically she's providing breakfast for a bunch of college students. So that explains her absence, but I wish she could have been here. I always enjoy having her along, and she's definitely the better half in our family. It's a great pleasure to be able to come here and speak to you. Dave said he wanted to, in some ways, to introduce you to someone from the religion division. We're trying to be more of service, if you will, to the churches in Southern California, trying to reach out more. I know you had the young man Chris Chestnut here last year. We're hoping we can provide more young men like him to come and serve in various ways, short-term, maybe long-term, who knows. But we really feel like that's an important part of what it is that we do at Pepperdine. I know several of you this morning said you either could or you tried to come out for the lectureship that we had just a couple of weeks ago, and that's always a good thing. Dave, who's that right behind you?
A troublemaker.
That guy. Okay. An old face. My goodness, it's been a while. How are you?
Doing well.
Doing well, Dave. Good to see you. My goodness, it has been many, many years. It's amazing. If you stick around long enough, people keep rotating back into your lives. It's wonderful. Dave asked me this morning to talk about family. It's hard for me to do this in sermon style, so you're going to have to bear with me. I'm going to fall back into sort of my teaching mode. I put people to sleep either preaching or teaching, so it, you know, in that way there's really no difference. But it is going to feel a little bit more maybe like a class lecture than a sermon so much. Although I hope it's not too much of a class lecture. But to talk about family and God's ideas for family, I'm not going to do what I heard one preacher do one time on the radio. I was driving across West Texas late one night, and the only radio station I could get was some preacher, and he wanted to talk about biblical families, and for some reason he had chosen the family of Jacob, who, if you know, had four wives, and I, as you can tell, I scratched my head then. I still scratch my head now, wondering exactly: are we supposed to think that we're all supposed to have four wives? I hope not. for many reasons. Don't think I have to go into them. And yet we know that from Scripture, we are taught what it is God expects of us to, you know, how we're supposed to understand families. Now, one way we could do this is just to say, okay, you know, you need to do these laws, you need to follow these commands, follow these examples, ignore those examples, those were bad examples. What I want to talk about this morning is more underlying principles, and I'll leave it up to you folks to decide exactly the proper ways for you in your own lives to be applying these principles. I'm hoping to sort of plant some seeds, to give you some ideas, and then I'll let the flowers come out as they will in each of your own lives. I particularly wanted this these two scriptures read for a couple of reasons, both from the book of Deuteronomy. The first one, I'm sure that you know, what we call the Shema. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one. You shall love the Lord with all your heart. We know that one. We know that's one that when the Jews came to Jesus and said, what is the greatest commandment? That's the one that he quoted. And we all know that one. There's another passage we're going to be referring to that, again, I think you're familiar with from Ephesians chapters 5 and 6, one of the two places where Paul gives several commands to different members of the family. Husbands, love your wives, you know, all of those things. We're going to get to those. But I wanted you to hear the passage from Deuteronomy chapter 16. Because I'm convinced that it gives us a biblical picture, if you will, of what a family was to them. I mean, if you were to ask someone today, what is a family, you probably would have an image in your mind, like I remember from a book that was popular when I was young. It was something like, whatever happened to mom, dad, and the kids? That's a family, right? Mom, dad, kids. You got a family. Here in Deuteronomy 16, as they're talking about, in this case, the Feast of Weeks, Pentecost. Okay, they're all coming together as family, or as families. Okay? Now, throughout Deuteronomy, Moses is talking here, and he keeps talking about you. You shall do this, you shall not do this, you should all come together. And it's... he just keeps saying, you. Here's one of the few passages where he expands on what he means by you. And what he's doing is he's talking to family to family to family. Each you out there is a family. So now notice who this is. In verse 11, chapter 16, verse 11. So they're coming together to worship. Okay, you got that? They're coming together to worship. He says, rejoice before the Lord your God at the place he will choose as a dwelling for his name, you. And then it's like he says, so let me spell out who you is. How do you like my grammar there? Who is you? Who you is? You, your sons and daughters, your men servants and maid servants, the Levites in your towns, and the aliens, the fatherless, and the widows living among you. Now, do you hear that? That is one family. You, your children, your servants, the Levites, the aliens, the orphans, the widows. You're all one big, hopefully happy family. That's their definition. That's their assumption about what a family involved, about who was included. You see, in our society, we like to think, okay, it's mom and dad and the kids, and as soon as you can kick those kids out of the nest, it's just mom and dad, right? And that's your family. I say that because we're in the mode of kicking some kids right now. But notice how much bigger their idea of family is. Okay? It's not just the parents and the kids. You've also got these servants. And then you've got these other people over here who needs some taking care of. Now, let me explain that real quick, and I'll try to get out of this, and here we go. What are we doing with Levites and aliens and orphans and widows in this list? Well, the assumption is if you're a viable family, if you will, financially, that means you're going to be someone who has property. You're going to be inheriting some of the land. Brother Oliver talked this morning in class about the importance of the land. All of these people are tied to the land. All right? So if you're someone who has a name, then you have a right to the land. All right? And that's going to be the source of income. That's going to be the source of your financial stability. So who are these other folks? Who are these Levites, the aliens, the orphans, and the widows? Well, the Levites, if you'll recall, they're the ones who didn't get a tribal property, tribal allotment. They had to depend on all the people from all the other tribes to give them a place to live. So they're like landless people. And aliens, and I know the way we think of aliens is either people from outer space or from another country. But aliens, really, for these folks, that means someone who does not own property. We would call them today homeless. Okay? And then you've got orphans. I think we understand orphans, but think of this in particular in terms of owning property, giving yourself financial stability. So the orphans are the kids who don't have a father who owns property. They are dependent on somebody else who does. See, and then you can obviously understand widows. You see, in those days, a woman was dependent on her husband to have the stability of property. If her husband has died, she's cut off from that. So she has to rely on the mercy of someone who does have the property, who does have the financial stability to take care of her. So there's their understanding of family. It's people who have the financial means and all the people that are dependent on them. Now, you might say, well, maybe that was true in the Old Testament, but it's not true in the New Testament, is it? Well, it is. Of course, you're familiar with James chapter 1, where James talks about true religion is taking care of orphans and widows, but you ever thought about this with Ephesians chapter 5? Which I want us to go to. Ephesians chapter 5. And we could also, if we wanted to, see a shorter parallel in Colossians chapters 3 and 4. But you know this. You've heard this many, many times. Notice who is picked out. Ephesians chapter 5. Paul is talking about family. There's a fancy term, household codes, for this stuff. All right? But notice who is in the household here. He talks about in chapter 5 of Ephesians, he starts off in verse 21 saying, submit to one another out of reverence for Christ. And then who does he talk about? Wives in verse 22 and husbands in verse 25. All right, who else? Chapter 6, verse 1, children. In chapter 6, verse 4, fathers. All right, so we think that should be the whole family, right? We've got husbands and wives, parents and children. But Paul doesn't stop there, does he? Because he goes on to talk about slaves obeying your masters, and verse 9, masters treating your slaves in the same way. You see what the assumption is? He's talking about family. He's talking about the household. In their houses, that included the people that worked for them. Wow. Now there's a concept for you. What if we had the idea that where we worked, that the people there were family? Well, that's not the world that we live in, but it's an interesting concept to think about. Well, here's what I want us to do now. Starting really now, moving from chapter 5 of Ephesians, chapters 5 and 6, thinking about that as family, let's notice the principles that are involved in these relationships, these family relationships. Okay? And I'm doing these in three pairs: husbands and wives, parents and children, and then masters and slaves, or we might say employers, employees. All right, something like that. And I just want to throw in a few ideas. So what I see is basic principles, and then, like I said, leave it to you folks to figure out how you would flesh that out, how that would look in your own lives. First of all, what are some principles? We're talking about family values, family relationships. What are some principles that are very, very biblical, that are core in the Bible, having to do with husbands and wives? Well, we start really just virtually at the very, very beginning of the Bible with that one, don't we? You think about Genesis chapter 2, the first people that are made, the first humans that are made as a couple. You know, God shapes, God sculpts the man out of the dust of the earth, and then he forms, he builds, literally, the wife, the woman, out of the side of the man. And then what does he say? What does Moses say here at the end of this, when Eve is brought to Adam? In Genesis chapter 2, verse 23, so the man said, "This now is bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh, and she shall be called woman, for she was taken out of man." And then here's the verse 24. "For this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and they will become one flesh." Will leave his father and mother, be united to his wife, will cleave to his wife, and they will be one flesh. Now, first of all, notice the strong sense of unity here. One thing that struck me as I was preparing this lesson was, there's very, very little that points toward hierarchy, you know, who is over whom in family. There's much more about unity, about how what you have in a family is many people, but all working as one. And that's being stressed here. You see, the two shall become one. Did you notice over there in Deuteronomy 16, when I read quickly through that list that kind of spells out who the family is, how does it begin? You, your sons and daughters. Hey, wait a minute, Moses, you skipped somebody. I didn't hear wife in there. Here's what I think. I think when he says you, he's thinking husband-wife. As one, the two have truly become one. So he hasn't skipped the wives. It's that they're not separable in his mind. Now, there's a concept that I think we need to restore, that we need to hold on to and really dwell on in our thinking, because that's not the way that we are taught in our society. You know, we're taught so much about how, well, I have to stand up for myself. How much, I can't believe some of the things that I read sometimes about how people view marriage, how easy it is to get out of it. Well, you know, we went our separate ways. How can something that is one go separate ways? I mean, I know that there are divorces. I know that happened, but for it to be taken so lightly, for people to act like, well, it's just a matter of course. Come on. That is not the way it's intended. See, notice, here's maybe another clue. What does he say? You leave your father and mother and cling to your wife. Hey, folks, it strikes me, first of all, that he's talking about the husbands, the men, leaving their families. I may say a little something about the attitude. As a guy, I like to think, oh, my wife left her family because she wanted to be with me. So that's a little bit selfish on my part. Because what he says is that this is why a man leaves his father and mother and cleaves to his wife. You know what that assumes as well? That's a tough thing to do. For a young man to leave his father and mother and cling to his wife. Now, here's something I just I don't know if I just discovered it or if I rediscovered it, but a couple of weeks ago in a class for the college students at our church, we were finishing up Matthew chapter 10. Turn with me to Matthew chapter 10, because I'll put a couple of passages together, and I think in Jesus we see a beautiful example of a man leaving his father and mother in order to marry his wife. All right? So bear with me. In Matthew chapter 10, toward the end of the chapter, let's start in verse 35. Jesus is speaking here, and Jesus says, "I have come to turn a man against his father, a daughter against her mother, a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. A man's enemies will be the members of his own household." And then here, "Anyone who loves his father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. Anyone who loves his son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. And anyone who does not take up his cross and follow me is not worthy of me." Now notice especially, "Anyone who loves his father or mother more than me is not worthy of me." And you have to take up your cross. The thought that struck me was, that's exactly what Jesus did. I spoke about this for a few minutes. I did the communion meditation last Sunday at our church. Remember, it was Mother's Day. And it struck me that what Jesus was doing in dying on the cross was he was leaving his mother. You remember that scene that John talks about where Jesus is hanging there on the cross and he sees John there and he says, "John, behold your mother." You see, Jesus is having to leave his mom. He is separating himself from his mother. Now, that's a huge, first of all, responsibility on the part of a young man. His mother is a widow. Who is going to take care of her? This is his responsibility. What is more, it is probably his primary love, you know, between himself and another human being. His love for his mother. And he is saying, like he's telling his disciples, you have to love me. You have to love something else more than father and mother. That's what Jesus does. He takes up his cross. He leaves his mother in order to do what? In order to be sacrificed, but more than that, in order to be married to his bride. And who is his bride? The church. See, what does Paul say in Ephesians chapter 5? Ephesians chapter 5, verse 25. "Husbands, love your wives just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her to make her holy, cleansing her by the washing with water through the word, and to present her to himself as a radiant church without stain or wrinkle or any other blemish, but holy and blameless." Wow. What a beautiful example of what is supposed to go on in a marriage. To give up what is most dear to you, gentlemen. To give up the most important relationship you have had your entire life in order to give yourself to your bride. That's the picture. That's the example that Jesus sets for us. All right, so there's one third of a family relationship. I got to get going. Boy, I've got a bunch more. All right, I warn you. All right, number two. If you're numbering these things, we'll number this one number two. I don't know what number one, zero was, but all right, husbands and wives. So there's some basic principles. Chew on those. A second one. Parents and children. Now, for this, let's go back. We'll start in Deuteronomy again with that Deuteronomy 6 passage, the Shema, you shall love the Lord. What does he say there? Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength. These commandments that I give you today are to be upon your hearts. Impress them on your children. See, what are we supposed to be teaching our children as Christians? First and foremost, love the Lord your God. Not your parents. Love the Lord your God with all your heart. That's number one. That's what we need to be teaching our children. What does that mean, though? I hear so many people who say, oh, I love Jesus. I love God. And then they just tend to think, so if I love God, whatever I choose to do must be okay. But they give us more detail, okay? What does it mean to love the Lord with all your heart? Well, let me just give you a few examples. I guarantee you there are many, many more. But let me just give you a few examples from Deuteronomy. Because if Moses here, inspired by God, is saying love the Lord with all your heart, then other things that he says about the hearts of the people there should be implied in that. Doesn't that make sense? So let's just notice a few things that Moses says in Deuteronomy about hearts, about how to have the right kind of heart, the kind of heart that we should have if we are believing in God. Okay, turn to Deuteronomy chapter 8, for example. Deuteronomy chapter 8. Here's one that should sound familiar, at least part of it. Chapter 8, the first couple of verses. I think the point here is, if you love the Lord with all your heart, then that means you're going to rely on God. You're going to realize you rely on God. He says, be careful to follow every command I'm giving you today, so that you may live and increase and may enter and possess the land the Lord promised on oath to your forefathers. Remember how the Lord your God led you all the way in the desert these 40 years to humble you and to test you in order to know what was in your heart, whether or not you would keep his commands. He humbled you, causing you to hunger and then feeding you with manna, which neither you nor your fathers had known, to teach you what? That man does not live on bread alone, but on every word that comes from the mouth of the Lord. God was testing them to know what was in their heart. God was teaching them in the wilderness to rely on them. This is something we need to be teaching our children. I love the way Bob did it this morning in class. What you were quoting from a verse. Oh, I wish I could remember exactly which one it was. But he threw in 401k instead of trust in him. You know? If you'll just trust in your 401k. No, I'm sorry. If you'll trust in him. What do we teach our children? Where do we teach them they're going to find security? That they're going to find happiness? That they're going to be okay? If you'll just do... Have we not learned ourselves the necessity of relying on God? You know, some people say, well, you know, I had this really... amazing, if you will, conversion experience. I used to be so bad, and then I realized how badly I needed God, and now I do. But now I'm raising my children, and they haven't had that experience. So how are they supposed to know? You have to teach them. See, this is what was going on with these folks. They had 40 years, a whole generation of going through the wilderness. And yet what Moses is doing is saying, you've got to teach the next generation, and they've got to teach the next generation. And on and on and on. And we all have experiences. For myself, this is so minor, but I'll bring it up anyway. This is a petty example. But I think back in my own life to the time when you talked about we moved from Texas to Massachusetts to go to school. Wow. That was a shock in many ways. One of them was the price of living to go from Texas to Massachusetts. We moved up there. We had saved up. My wife and I had been married a couple of years at this point. We'd been saving up money. We moved up there, and just to get moved in, they required that you give them the cost of the first month's rent, the last month's rent, and another whole month's rent as security deposit. So 3 months up front. So we gave them that, and then we looked at each other and we realized we've got enough money to pay half the rent the next month around. And we've got to eat and pay utilities. Wow. Talk about a wake-up call. And that's the way we went. You know, it was a week to week, later a month to month. You know, you just struggle through that. But that is so minor compared to what so many other people go through. But it's times like that that you realize how much you really are dependent on God. Now, it might come in the form of, you know, a little help from these people over here or a check from these, you know, whatever. In our case, it was 5 part-time jobs that we amassed over that fall. But you realize, wow, God is really working here. We have to pass that on to our children. Oh, there's one. Another one. Now, okay, this is going to sound un-American, but here we go. Also in chapter 8. Deuteronomy chapter 8. In verse 17, he says, "You may say to yourself." Okay, what does that have to do with heart? Well, in Hebrew it does. Some of the translations, maybe in the King James or the New American Standard, if you look at a different translation, some of the other translations will say it more literally. He says, "You may say in your heart." You're supposed to love the Lord your God with all your heart. If you do, look, what do you say in your heart? He says, "You may say, my power and the strength of my hands have produced this wealth for me." So here's someone who has gained wealth in the promised land. And so he says, you're going to have this temptation to say, it was because I worked so hard. It was because I believed in myself and my ability to do something. He says, if you love the Lord your God with all your heart, that's not what you're going to say in your heart. You might be tempted to, but he says, don't do that. He says, you might say that, but instead, remember the Lord your God. If you love the Lord with all your heart, remember Him in these times. Remember that it is He who gives you the ability to produce wealth. And so He confirms His covenant, which He swore to your fathers as it is today. Do you hear that? He's not saying, so don't work hard. He's not saying that at all. But what he is saying is, work hard, but always remember who gives you the strength, the ability, the opportunity to do the work that you do. Don't forget where that comes from. Because if you do, then you start thinking, you're a self-made man. You know, I am who I am because of what I did. And not anybody else. And that's not what you do when you love the Lord with all your heart. I could give you some. Let me give you one other one. Chapter 15. I've got several more, but Deuteronomy chapter 15. And we'll use this one to get into our final. In Deuteronomy 15 in verse 7, notice the imagery that starts here. He says, if there's a poor man among your brothers in any of the towns of the land that the Lord your God is giving you, don't be hard-hearted. Hear that? If you love the Lord with all your heart, you're not going to be hard-hearted toward the poor or tight-fisted toward your brother. You see that? You see? Tight-fisted. He said, rather be open-handed and freely lend him whatever he needs. Be careful not to harbor a wicked thought, like in your heart, and say, oh, we're about to cancel the debts and all that. Verse 10, give generously to him and do so without a grudging heart. Then because of this, the Lord your God will bless you in all your work and in everything you put your hand to do. You hear that? There's such an attitude right now in our country of, I've worked hard for this, so I'm going to hold on to it. Why should I give it to somebody else? I earned this. He says, if you love the Lord with all your heart, you open your hands. You're generous. See, that's the way it is. All right, so these are the sorts of things that we're supposed to be teaching our children. If I were to summarize it all, it would be like this. Do unto others as God has done unto you. Okay? Just a little twist on the golden rule. Not just do unto others as you would have them do unto you, but do unto others as God has done unto you. See, that's what God has done unto us. He has freely opened His hands and blessed these people. And He's simply asking them to do the same thing. All right, so there's two. Another bit of family, and these kind of go together. Slaves and masters. Okay, people that work for you, people that work with you. Also a part of your family. One passage from the Old Testament, real quick, just to make this point. In the book of Job, buried deep in the book of Job, long after you've given up on Job, over in chapter 31, Job makes this statement. He's defending his righteousness. And at one point he says, if I have denied justice to my men servants and maid servants when they had a grievance against me, what will I do when God confronts me? What will I answer when I am called to account? Did not, and here's the point, did not He who made me in the womb make them? Did not the same one form us both within our mothers? See, we like to think, to stratify ourselves. Somehow I'm better than, or he's better than, or she's better. He says, we all come from the same source. God made each and every one of us. So this is Job's attitude. A very, very wealthy man with lots of people working for him. And his attitude is, the God who made me is the same God who made them. So we are all the same in God's eyes. You know, there's a little bit of that in our Constitution and in the Declaration of Independence. You know? All men are created equal. Where did they get that concept? Because we're all made by the same God. And you see that then also in what Paul says in Ephesians chapter 6. You know, when he's talking about the attitude that masters and slaves are supposed to have, right? Slaves, obey your earthly masters with respect and fear and with sincerity of heart, just as you would obey Christ, right? And then masters, treat your slaves in the same way. Don't threaten them, since you know that he who is both their master and yours is in heaven. Yeah? I'm above him because I'm chair of the division, of a division at Pepperdine, so there's these people that work for me. So what? I got someone above me, and he's got someone above him. We're all the same. And that's the attitude that we need to have as family. And isn't this the attitude that Jesus has? It's amazing. If anyone had the claim, the right to claim superiority, it's Jesus. But what does Jesus say? Jesus says, I came not to be served, but to serve. That's the attitude of family. Not to be served, but to serve. He gives the example on the night before he's betrayed of washing his disciples' feet and says, follow this example. That's the attitude that we're supposed to have as family. Well, have I gone over time. I apologize. Let me close, though, with this. If you go back and look at Deuteronomy chapter 16, where he talks about everybody coming together, the you and your servants and your children and everyone, they all come together to worship like we are here today. What are you supposed to do when you come together to worship? Remember. We gather around a table to remember. What are we supposed to remember? In Deuteronomy, it was remember that what? You used to be slaves. But God freed you from Egypt. Okay? You used to be slaves. Now you are free. Now you are husbands and wives. Now you have children. Now you own property rather than being owned. That's what has happened. The same thing is true of us. Paul talks about how we used to be slaves to sin. But now God has freed us from sin. We are to come together to be reminded of that. To be reminded that we used to be slaves, but now we are free. Jesus is the perfect example. He's one who could be totally free, totally in charge, and yet He chooses to be a slave. Yet we are free. He has freed us by making Himself our servant. He has freed us. John says in 1 John 3, what a wonderful thing it is that we can be called the children of God. And we are the bride of Christ. You see, all of this, this idea of family, it's just everywhere in what we do. And Jesus is the example in all of these things, laying out for us, being the example of the principles that we are supposed to own as the people of God, as the family of God. So this morning, I don't know where you are in your walk with God. I don't know where you are in your life with Christ. It could be that at this moment you're still a slave of sin. Jesus offers freedom to you. Jesus offers freedom, liberation from sin, so that you can be called children of God and become the bride of Christ. You do that through baptism. You do that through, as he says in Ephesians, you're going to be washed. You're going to be cleansed. You're going to be made blameless by the blood of Christ. It's a wonderful thing, and it changes our attitude. It changes the way that we think about our relationships to one another. It makes us the way God had always intended for us to be. It could be that you're a part of this body, you're a part of this family, but you kind of lost sight of how you're supposed to act to your other family members. Maybe you've been following the way we tend to do family in our world, you know, which is all this rivalry. Don't get on my side of the car seat or whatever. No, it's not a matter of hierarchy. It's a matter of unity. We are all one in Christ, one family. And we need to work toward that oneness, promoting that oneness. As Jesus did, who gave up His earthly family in order to die for and be married to His spiritual family. That's what we're all there. I could go on and on and on. I better stop. There's an invitation for you. If you want to respond to gain that freedom, to be liberated from your sin, or if you want the prayers of the other members of your family to join with you today, to offer up prayers to God, to reaffirm your commitment to this family, we ask you to come. We have a song. What's the number again, Eddie?
904.
Let's all stand together and sing.